Dartmouth Community Medical School. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Right after Labor Day, New Hampshire senators get down to business electing a new president. It's a task none of them expected until last week when current president Peter Bragdon was unveiled as the new head of the local government center. The LGC is a quasi-state agency that handles insurance and workers' compensation for municipalities, school districts, and counties. It has a lot of dealings with the legislature, and that's why many felt Bragdon continuing as Senate president might present a conflict of interest. And so last week, the Republican from Milford said he'd relinquish his leadership post, but will continue to represent his district in the Senate. Soon after, the name Chuck Morse arose as Bragdon's possible successor, a Republican from Salem, and over the next 2 weeks, other names could emerge. This political shift at the State House was just one of many headlines in these dog days of summer all around the Granite State. In the North Country, opponents of the Northern Pass Project scoffed at a new offer for an economic development fund, while down in D.C., New Hampshire's delegation asked for a cabinet-level review of the hydropower project. In Manchester, 200 more refugees may be coming, and on the seacoast, commercial flights return to the former Pease Air Force Base. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and let's get you into our conversation. Your comments, thoughts, questions about these headlines, and others that might have caught your attention this week. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We have two guests with us for the roundup. Gary Reno's here, State House reporter for the Union Leader in New Hampshire Sunday News. And Gary, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here, Laura.
Also with us, Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter for the Concord Monitor, covering New Hampshire politics and state government. And Ben, welcome back and good to see you too.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Ben, let's start with the state Senate. Right after Labor Day, as I said, state senators will sit down to pick a new president. We'll talk about who that might be in just a minute. But let's talk, Ben, about the man who's stepping down, Peter Bragdon. What was his style as Senate president? How was he viewed?
Well, you know, Peter Bragdon was, I think, well-liked and well-respected by his colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats. He did a lot this year, especially within the Republican caucus, he and Jeb Bradley, the majority leader, to hold together the Republicans. You know, they only have a 13-11 majority in the Senate with the Democrats in control of the governor's office and the House. That left Peter Bragdon as effectively the most powerful Republican in the state. And he did a lot to block stuff that they didn't want through, including Medicaid expansion, which was delayed at least, various repeals of stuff that happened. And he did it in a way that I think he was considered generally fair-minded and courteous on the floor. He's someone who likes to follow the rules, and I think his colleagues like that, which is one of the reasons why it was so surprising how quickly things snowballed last week when he took this job as the new head of the LGC and 3 days later has to say, I'm stepping down as Senate president.
Yeah, it did happen very quickly. Friday on the news roundup last week, we talked about how many were saying he should step down. And then shortly after that day or the next day, he said he would step down. So it did happen quickly.
It did. And that was about noon on Friday that he said he would step down. And he says he still believes that it's possible in terms of administrative tasks, in terms of his actual duties as Senate president, to balance being the head of this organization and running the Senate, that he can recuse himself on things that are a conflict. But that he also said at the end of the week that he understood the argument that the role of the Senate president is broader than that of an individual senator, and that those conflicts are a lot easier to manage when you're not holding the gavel. I think there was a lot of praise that came at that point from Republicans who had previously not been saying much about that situation, had not been leaping to his defense. Democrats still aren't happy. They say some of them are still saying he should resign from the Senate. Some of them are trying to poke holes in the timeline of his hiring, trying to point out that there are still potential conflicts there. So the debate's not over yet, even though he is preparing to step down as president.
Well, and picking up something you said, Ben, the role of a Senate president and how that's different from a regular senator. Gary Reno, you had a real interesting piece talking about that role and how different people have played that role over the years. Mm-hmm. How important is the Senate president versus a regular senator?
Well, the Senate president decides basically everything in that's going on in the Senate. They set the agenda. They appoint the committees. They decide which bills are going where. It's just open for all sorts of problems. If you have a job like the executive director of the local government center, he's the person who decides what the budget ultimately would be. I mean, you have Chuck Morris, who's the Senate finance chairman, but it's all got to go through Peter or whoever is the Senate president. That doesn't get decided without the Senate president saying, this is fine, this isn't fine. And now you're talking about an organization that includes all the cities and towns and the school districts in the state, pretty much. And whenever you pass a budget, I mean, a huge hunk of that budget in the state goes to the cities and towns and school districts. And it just opens it all up to all kinds of questions.
Ben, go ahead.
Well, and beyond the budget, there is another power of the Senate president, and that is to appoint members of study committees, of study commissions. And there's actually a study committee that's at work right now on the LGC, a committee that was created this year to look at the administrative hearing officer's order from last year in the ongoing legal case, the fight between the LGC and its state regulator. And that committee has been set up to review if there needs to be changes to state law in response to that controversy. Peter Bragdon appointed one of the members of that committee, Senator Jeanie Forrester. Now, he says he decided to appoint her before he was approached about the LGC job. Documents that came out this week, emails that have been requested under the Right to Know law by the state Democratic Party, show that he sought her advice, Senator Forrester's advice, before he formally appointed her to the committee. They both say he actually decided to appoint her before then. But that's another area where the Senate president has influence that has become something of a question in this.
Let me invite our listeners to join us. And then I have a couple more questions about this for you, including who might replace Peter Bragdon. The name Chuck Morris keeps coming up. The number for you to join our roundup is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Some of the stories we're covering this hour, the shakeup at the New Hampshire Senate with a new president to be elected right after Labor Day. We've been looking at that. Also, a little bit later on, we'll talk about the first mosquitoes with triple E have been confirmed in the Granite State. And a new CDC report says there's a huge increase in the number of Lyme disease cases in the Northeast. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions and comments on these headlines and more. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org if you'd like, or post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Gary, Senator Chuck Morris, widely viewed as the guy to replace Senator Bragdon as president. Is there anyone else who also might throw their hat in the ring?
Well, it's plenty of time for mischief, as they say, between now and September 3rd. But from what I think we've been able to understand, Senator Morris has pretty much everyone except one of the Senate Republicans on board. The one exception appears to be Mr. Sanborn. And he seems to go back and forth as to whether – I think at one point he was entertaining thoughts of getting in the race, but
– this is Senator Andy Sanborn owns a business
here
in Concord,
the draft,
lives in Bedford, I believe.
Lives in Bradford now. You can see where the Senate is ripe for a situation that happened in like the late 90s where two Republicans joined with the Democrats to make Ralph Huff the Senate president. You could see a situation like that because there are several moderate Republicans who probably often vote more with the Democrats than Republicans sometimes. But Andy Samman probably is not the person to do that with the Democrats at this point.
He's also said to be considering running for governor or other possibilities. Yeah, interesting. So, Senator Morris, so how will he be sort of different from Peter Bragdon? My experience with both gentlemen is that they have very different personalities.
They do. He's a lot more volatile than Peter Bragdon is. I should say probably emotional might be a better word. But he likes to keep things in his control, very much so. And you could see it as when he was Senate Finance Chairman, he was running the show. It was his show, and he was going to decide this, that, and the committee is going to come along with him. Whereas Peter was much more throw it open, let's see where we go. I think you'll see Senator Morris would be much more direct and much more straightforward about where he wants to go and what he wants done. And people will, some of them will like it, some of them won't.
And it sounds like Republicans largely support Senator Morris. Ben, what about Democrats? How do they feel about working with Senate President Morris?
Well, you know, the Democrats do have some experience working with him on the Senate Finance Committee. He's chaired that for the last two budget cycles. And so the last two state budgets have had his fingerprints all over them. And especially this past year, the budget that came out of the Senate Finance Committee was a party line budget. It was a Republican budget. But it also, the final budget that came out of the conference committee looked a lot like that. It was, of course, the later of the two budgets from the House and the Senate, so it had more up-to-date revenue figures, which made it easier to make spending decisions. But a lot of the priorities that were in the Senate budget made it into the final document. It eventually passed 24-0 in the Senate, and Chuck Morse got a lot of praise for that.
So, 24-0.
And everyone was saying
in
that's
an almost
pretty
divided
much
Senate.
Unprecedented for a budget to get that kind of support. It was nearly unanimous in the House, but it was unanimous in the Senate, and Chuck Morse got a lot of credit for that.
Real quickly, gentlemen, Republicans this week pointed out that a Democratic senator, Jeff Wordburner of Dalton in the North Country, also has a job that has business before the state. He's part-time executive director of a group called the Council for Children and Adolescents with Chronic Health Conditions. And Gary Rayner, Republicans are saying, hey, why aren't Democrats as worried about this as they were about Peter Bragdon?
Well, I think you have to go back to what Peter Bragdon said when they first announced that he was going to be the executive director of the LGC, which is we are a volunteer legislature. We're a citizens' legislature. We are going to have jobs that are outside the political realm, and there are going to be conflicts. And frankly, if this is the best that the Republicans do for the Democrats, then the Democrats don't have a lot to worry about. And whenever you start raising these issues, you always have to worry about what's going to come back at you. And probably there's plenty to come back at the Republicans. I mean, there are certainly conflicts with the Democrats who are serving in the Senate. There are a lot of conflicts with the Republicans serving in the Senate.
This comes up a lot when you have people who are paid $100 a year. Or 125 for the
Senate
state. All right. We'll follow up after a short break. We'll start taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, we're going to talk to Dr. Jose Montero, New Hampshire's public health director, about the rise in insect-borne diseases in the Granite State. That and a lot more. You can join us 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And you can support this 24-hour news service by becoming a member of NHPR's Leadership Circle. Your $100 monthly gift to NHPR helps preserve independent and reliable journalism in New Hampshire. Find out more about NHPR's Leadership Circle and make your gift at nhpr.org. New Hampshire weather, partly sunny today. Slight chance of scattered showers. Highs upper 60s north of the mountains, mid-70s to lower 80s for the remainder of the state. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Conway Scenic Railroad, celebrating its 39th year, featuring fine dining on the Notch Train. Schedules, menus, and ticket information online at conwayscenic.com. And from Benchmark Senior Living and Memory Care Communities in Bedford, Concord, Nashua, and Salem, supporting the Walk to End Alzheimer's, September 28th in Manchester. Details at alz.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Today in The Exchange, our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're looking at some of the top headlines of the week, including a political shakeup at the state Senate. Later on, we'll be looking at some developments with the Northern Pass Project. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests for the hour are Ben Loopsdorf with the Concord Monitor and Gary Reyna with the Union Leader. And now I want to bring another voice into our conversation to cover a major headline this week. Dr. Jose Montero is with us. He's New Hampshire's public health director. And Dr. Montero, welcome.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, thank you. A new CDC report, Dr. Montero, shows Lyme disease is 10 times more common than previous national counts. How did these numbers jump up so quickly all of a sudden, Dr. Montero?
Well, I wish we had the chance to review that report that CDC announced over the weekend. What they are saying is that there are many cases that do not get reported to the state, so they estimate that there may be 10 times more cases than what we report. Those things are based in work done in the 90s, early 2000s, about prevalence and claims data. We only report on those that clinicians report to us. So certainly a lot of cases are missing.
Sure, unreported cases. So this is CDC's attempt to kind of make up the gap there.
Yeah, and increase the level of awareness for everybody to report and test. We have been saying for quite some time that we need better reporting, and we have been working with the clinicians in New Hampshire, partnering with the medical society, doing education so this disease gets diagnosed earlier and reported so we have a better sense of what's going on.
You know, more people are starting to say, Dr. Montero, why are we spending so much time and money on mosquito-borne illnesses, Triple E, West Nile, you know, towns are spraying for this and so forth, when Lyme seems to be taking a much bigger toll?
Well, that's a really valid question. The people who have suffered for West Nile or Triple E illness themselves or a loved one will argue in opposition to that. Beyond that point, certainly we need to do a lot more in control of Lyme disease, and not just Lyme disease, but all of those diseases that come with ticks. We need to remember that we now are talking about Ehrlichia and anaplasmosis, that are diseases that are being more and more diagnosed every time more. And this year, we even reported the first case of a Powassan infection in New Hampshire. So ticks bring more than Lyme, and this is a serious disease. We are reporting 1,200 cases a year.
Wow.
And again, we are reporting. How many are missed? We have no good way to know that. So certainly more need to be done. But now the problem is, what do we do?
Right. Can you spray for ticks, Dr. Montero, like they spray for mosquitoes?
There is no really good system to do that because the ticks are all over the place.
Mm.
Then do you control deer population? Do you control mice population? Do you try to remove the ticks from the deer? All of those are incredibly expensive options that require a regional approach. We cannot do it in one town or one city because deer move, as do mice, so that doesn't help. So certainly more work needs to be done in the control of Lyme disease. In the meantime, prevention is golden, and early diagnosis and treatment is great.
Sure. So with mosquito spraying, you know, often there's a pool or a swamp or an area where you can kind of say, okay, a lot of them are here. With ticks, I understand what you're saying, Dr. Montero. They're all over the place.
They are all over the place. Actually, mosquitoes, too. What you do is to try to get rid of those that are close to you. But then with mosquitoes, you can control, at least for a week or two, the mosquito population. With ticks, since it's deer, who are moving in a particular region is different, and that poses a different type of challenge and problem.
Well, given these rising numbers and rising concern about Lyme disease, and as you say, Dr. Montero, other tick-borne illnesses, what about a vaccine for this? I mean, you and I have talked about this before, and I've gotten questions from listeners before. Hey, I can treat my cat or my dog real easily with a monthly treatment. Why can't we do something like that for people, given the rise, given the concern?
Yeah, there was a vaccine in the market maybe 6, 8, 10 years ago. I actually don't even remember exactly anymore. It was removed from the market, and there are two versions on that. One is because there was not enough market, and it was not selling.
Mm.
Some others say that there were some pain or symptoms caused by or related to that particular vaccine. But then again, if it was 10 years ago, we are talking about, in a state like New Hampshire, 100 cases. Today, we are talking about 1,200 cases that we know of. So certainly things have changed, but the development of vaccines is incredibly costly and time-consuming. It's many years of testing and trying before it gets to the market, and pharmaceutical companies assess the market before jumping into it. So we have nothing as a state agency or as a public health system that we can do about it.
Well, one more question for you, if I could, Dr. Montero. And turning away from Lyme disease and tick diseases and to Triple E, the first mosquitoes tested positive this week for Triple E. Where were they found, and what does this mean for the whole state?
We keep saying that the fact that we report positive Triple E's or mosquitoes or West Nile is almost not relevant. We need to assume always that they are here all over the place. It's hard to identify the positive mosquitoes. We got Exeter and Manchester with positive West Nile virus mosquitoes, but we have already Nashua, Stratham, Pelham, Sandown, and I think that Kensington with positive West Nile, which is in the regional tradition, in the region that traditionally we identify that. That basically highlights the, what we have been saying, that we need to do a lot more for personal prevention, because the mosquitoes are there, are active. So you need to be careful, mindful of using mosquito repellent, having your house protected with your windows and doors, fully protected, not standing water in your surroundings, and use mosquito repellent when you go out. Please enjoy this state. It's beautiful. Be physically active. That prevents obesity. That is way a higher risk than that West Nile or Tripoli. But just protect yourself when you are out there.
All right. Dr. Montero, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for it.
That's Dr. Jose Montero, New Hampshire's Public Health Director. The number for you to join our New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Gary Reno, Ben Loubsdorf, a couple other major news items that I did want to ask you guys about. Two big news stories this week, Ben, about the Northern Pass Project. First, on Monday, Northern Pass officials announced a $7.5 million jobs initiative for the North Country. What's this all about, Ben?
Well, this is a reflection, I think, of the fact that Northern Pass and the advocates of Northern Pass still haven't won over the North Country. Quite the opposite, in fact. This project remains controversial, especially among folks up north who think that this is going to hurt their views, hurt their property, hurt the character of the state, these tall towers carrying transmission lines. So Gary Long from Northeast Utilities and the Northern Pass folks held a press conference and announced that there's going to be a $7.5 million job fund for Coos County, I believe. But there's a catch. And the catch is that you get the money if the project's approved, that this would be happening in addition to the construction jobs, in addition to the permanent jobs created by the Northern Pass Project. They will make sure that there is investment in jobs in the North Country, but you get the money if you approve the project. Some folks who support this say, of course, a business would never invest in something if they're getting nothing back. Won't say it looks like a bribe that you're saying if you give up the opposition, we'll give you money for jobs. I'm not sure this is going to be the thing that turns a lot of North Country folks away from opposing this project. But it is, I think, emblematic of the way that Northern Pass is trying to win people over, is trying on several different fronts to gain support on this in terms of burying some of their lines, in terms of this. They're making efforts to win people over.
Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Gary, I'd love your thoughts on this too. Your paper reported on this jobs fund and the reaction in the North Country. I'm interested in what Ben said. You know, how much does this tip the balance in Northern Pass's favor? Ben's saying it's part of a larger effort. It may not be the one thing that turns this around.
No, and I don't think it's going to really swing a lot of people to their side in the North Country, where it's very unpopular. I mean, you don't have to go too far north of Concord to start seeing signs about not here, we don't want it. But I think the other thing that's interesting is there's the congressional front, which is also calling on a higher level review of particularly the area in the Connecticut headwaters where they want to bury the lines. That they really need to take a very serious look at this, and in terms of the federal agencies, and whether or not that's a good thing or not, or whether that's a violation of the deeds where the land was given to the state and the federal government.
So. Yeah, give us a little more on that, because that was the other item I wanted to ask you guys about. Down in D.C., as you said, New Hampshire's congressional delegation got involved in the Northern Pass, sent letters to the Secretaries of Energy and Agriculture seeking expanded environmental review. Is that normal procedure, Gary, for the state's delegation to come together and push federal agencies to review a project like this?
No, not really, but I mean, certainly, I think in a case like this, it's certainly to be expected. You're not going to just sort of say this is okay, because a lot of effort on a lot of people's parts has gone into protecting land in the North Country.
And Gene Shaheen and Judge Greg wrote a piece about this. Yeah.
You know, so they're not going to just stand by and say this is okay. You know, we want to make sure that everything is protected that we worked on to save, and that's what they're asking to do right now.
Ben, do you want to jump in?
Well, and in addition to the specifics of the Headwaters easement concern, I think this is one more example of the congressional delegation. They haven't come out against the Northern Pass project, but the delegation hasn't exactly been on the fence either. They've repeatedly expressed skepticism about some of the proposals that have been made, especially some of the early routes that were proposed, about the need for high-level review of a lot of these. Because it crosses an international border, it requires a presidential permit. There's permission that's needed to go through the White Mountain Forest. So I think that they're, given the large federal component of this, the congressional delegation has been reflecting the skepticism of a lot of folks in New Hampshire about this project, even if they haven't come out yet and said, or will come out and say, we oppose this project altogether. No one's in a position yet to do that in terms of either Governor Hassan or the congressional delegation, but they haven't been cheerleaders for this either.
Wow, it's interesting to think about what a high level of federal review this gets then. Given those points that you raised, it's an international project, there's federal land and so forth. I hadn't thought about that, Ben. So interesting. Gary, do you want to jump in real quick on that? Or okay. All right, well, moving on to something that I know, Gary, you have been talking about, and that's a group of new refugees coming to the Queen City, Manchester. When are they coming, roughly, Gary, and where are they coming from?
Well, they're coming from all over. It's not a lot of them were Bhutanese, but this group that's supposedly coming is a much more diverse group. Coming in a little while, if we think back several years ago, Mayor Ted Gatzes, who said, hold it, we want to stop this for now. The city needs to catch its breath. He thought he had an agreement with the group that resettles the refugees in New Hampshire.
The International Institute.
Yep, from New England. And, and now he's saying, well, they've broken their word. But the Institute was saying, well, it was a one-year agreement, and we did hold off for a year, and now we're starting again. And it remains to be seen how the city reacts. But certainly it's not unexpected, shall we say.
Given the concerns that Mayor Gatzes has expressed. Well, and he has said, you know, we should slow it down. He said, I'm not opposed to new people coming in. You know, they add to the city, but we should slow it down. So some say that's a legitimate point. Others say it's an excuse. How are people in Manchester interpreting that? No, we're not anti-refugee. We just need to, as Mayor Gatzes says, take the time to fully integrate the folks who are already here.
I think there are legitimate issues that need to be addressed, such as the school system. I mean, the school system has, as they call it, the United Nations at Cap Central High, which they speak many, many different languages. Integrating these kids into the system has been a bit of an issue, but certainly the kids seem to integrate better than the parents do in a lot of ways. And some of the easy jobs that used to be available for the refugees, some of the light manufacturing jobs, a lot of that is left. So it's not quite as easy for people to find work, unskilled work, as it was before in Manchester.
Yeah, the State Department looks at Manchester and Nashua and says, low unemployment, lots of jobs. But you're saying, Gary, some of those jobs may not necessarily fit.
Right.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in real quick, Ben?
Well, and I think that's right, what you just said. This goes beyond Manchester. There's obviously resettlement in Nashua and Concord and in Maine as well, in Minnesota, in places where the federal government looks and sees that there is a local economic environment that can absorb new folks coming in. It's one reason why a few years back refugee resettlement folks of Arab descent was moved further away from Detroit, where the traditional center of Arab America has been, because the local economy was having trouble absorbing these folks. And we see here in New England that there has been tensions not only here in Manchester, but in Maine as well, where there's been quite a bit of refugee resettlement.
In Lewiston
especially, there's been tensions with the local mayor, the local government there. Whether the state will step in, I don't know. There was an effort at one point to allow a local moratorium. That didn't go very far. But this is, in the end, a federal issue, and it's probably going to be something that Manchester is going to have to work with this nonprofit group and with the federal government on.
All right. Well, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Well, we've been talking about Manchester. I want to turn now to the Seacoast and go to NHPR's Seacoast reporter, Emily Corwin, with an update on a couple stories happening there. And Emily, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Laura.
Well, I think the news that a lot of people in the Seacoast were excited about this week, Emily, was the return of commercial air service at the former Pease Air Force Base. Who's coming, Emily?
Yeah, you know, at first, a lot of my friends, people I know, were putting their money on JetBlue, but it was Allegiant Air who made the announcement, and they'll be bringing commercial flights to Pease at the end of this October.
Allegiant Air. I have not heard of them, Emily.
You know, they were doing commercial flights from Pease way back until, I think, in 2003, but they left. And right now they've made Portsmouth one of 9 cities that they're adding to their repertoire, so to speak, this fall. All of these new cities that they're setting up go only to Sanford, Florida, right outside of Orlando. And their introductory flights that they're advertising are pretty low. They're $100 round trip.
Yeah, reminds me of People's Express in the 1980s, those $69
yeah.
flights. Emily, what are the local hopes around this? You know, the return of commercial air service to Pease.
I think people are excited that, maybe there will be more options, not just Orlando, and folks will have an easy way to come and go. Maybe it will be good for businesses here. But, it's just starting out here with just twice weekly trips to Orlando.
Well, and Emily, if you could hold on, we're heading into a break. And I did want to ask you also about a story that you've reported a lot on, New England farmers concerned about new federal regulations. So stay with us. I want to ask you about that. Real quickly, Gary Reno, remind us this Pease story. This is an ongoing saga to get commercial air service
there. Oh, it sure is. It goes back to when the base closed. Soon after it closed, there was a big effort to bring in Airbus maintenance facility into Pease. At the time, one of their big customers was Northwest Airlines, which was based in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and that's actually where the facility ended up. But soon after that, the PDA, or the Pease Development Authority, dumped a lot of money at Business Express.
I remember that.
The regional airlines, and ended up losing a lot of money. We've had Pan Am, we've had Allegiant Air. It's been quite a few people come and gone.
All right. Well, we'll see how this one works out. And Emily Corwin, stay with us. We're going to follow up with you also after a short break.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, a secret National Security Court ruling says the NSA violated the Constitution. President Obama promotes a new plan to make colleges more affordable, and then suspicions of a large-scale chemical attack in Syria. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Waste Management. Each person generates 4.5 pounds of waste each day, which is fueled to create renewable energy. See how waste to energy works at thinkgreen.com. And from New Hampshire Humanities Council, presenting Colin McCann, author of Let the Great World Spin, at its annual dinner on October 28th at the Center of New Hampshire. Details at nhhc.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we've been covering some of the top headlines of the week around the Granite State. We've looked at some developments in the Northern Pass Project. We've talked about the rise in Lyme disease and the discovery of mosquitoes with Triple E in Exeter, and also looked at the shakeup at the State Senate. If you want to join us on those stories or some of the other news items that caught your attention this week, join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We were talking just before the break with NHPR Seacoast reporter Emily Corwin about the return of commercial air service to Pease. Emily, I did want to ask you real quickly about another story that you've been covering, and that's New England farmers this week. Heard from federal officials who came to our area. Why were they here? What were they hoping to do talking with small farmers in New England, Emily?
Yeah, so they're talking about the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is the biggest reform of food safety laws in more than 70 years. It's an act that was passed by Congress back in December of 2010, but now the FDA, the Food Drug Administration, is in charge of implementing it. And, you know, there's a lot of rules about how you can grow food that's sold in the United States. It applies to both domestic and imported produce and products. And so on Tuesday, the FDA went to Hanover to speak at Dartmouth with a lot of the region's farmers. There are people there from, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine even. And they're trying to get feedback from New England farmers who they know at this point are not thrilled with the rules.
These come from, Emily, right, some pretty scary outbreaks we've seen in recent years of foodborne illnesses in produce like spinach or sprouts. You know, sometimes when people think foodborne problems, they think of undercooked chicken or meat. But this has come in, you know, good old healthy produce. So is that what's behind these new rules?
Yeah, it is. I think two things are behind the new rules. One is that 50% of our fruit and 20% of our vegetables are imported, and, you know, some of the rules apply to imported foods. And, you know, right now I don't think the United States has a lot of control over those food. And I think the FDA right now is feeling really reactive. There are these E. coli outbreaks. E. coli is what everybody's so worried about. And all they can do is react to them. They don't have really much in place to be able to prevent them. And so that's what they're hoping to do with these rules.
So some of the problem has come up with imported food, but some of it's been grown here in the United States, of course. What's the small farmer concern over these new regs?
So, right. So in New England, it's mostly small farmers. We have very, very few large farms. And these New England farms are really, they're less profitable than the big commercial growers in Indiana or Iowa. And so right now what they're doing here in New England is farmers are getting really creative, and they are staying viable by being vertical. They're aggregating other farmers' food. They're, you know, adding value by making soups, by making, you know, other products they can sell that, you know, help them stay sustainable. The problem, though, is that the rules were written with this sort of possibly more traditional understanding of what farmers do. And so, you know, Congress knew that complying with complicated FDA regulations would be hard for small farmers. But when they went about trying to, you know, to solve that problem, they created these very specific exemptions, if you sell less than $500,000 of produce a year, farmers don't have to comply. But what they didn't think about is that, you know, the farmers are going to get sort of stuck complying anyway because they don't fit any one clear definition. Are they just growing produce? Are they processing food? Are they actually an aggregator? And so farmers are finding that, you know, the exemption looks good on paper but doesn't apply to them possibly.
Wow.
And that's what's got them very concerned.
Well, Emily, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Emily Corwin, again, Seacoast reporter. For us here at NHPR, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our guests are Gary Reno with the Union Leader, New Hampshire Sunday News, and Ben Lubsdorf, staff reporter with the Concord Monitor. And both of you, I want to turn to a story that caused some upset on a few levels. This is a police shooting in Ware, the town of Ware, where police apparently shot and killed a fleeing suspect who, it seems like, was not armed. The attorney general is looking into this. What's the AG going to be examining, Ben?
Well, in any situation where there has been a police-involved shooting, the attorney general's office investigates to determine if it was justified. There is a state law that covers these situations when it is acceptable for police officers to use deadly force. It involves determining if there was a threat or if the officers had a reasonable belief that there was a threat to themselves or others.
I see. So whenever there's a police shooting,
whenever there
the AG looks at it.
It's conducted by the Attorney General's office to avoid a conflict of interest because, of course, the local police can't investigate themselves, and they work closely with county prosecutor's offices, with the county sheriff. So it's kicked up to the AG's office to look into. We haven't gotten that report yet. There's typically a preliminary report that makes a determination and summarizes the event and says this was justified, this was not justified, and a much more detailed narrative that's issued often a year or more later when the investigation is complete. We don't know all the facts yet in this case. We don't have that initial report yet. Certainly in this case, someone is dead and they're looking into it. And the officers, I believe, involved have, I believe, been put on administrative leave.
Wow. And this will be a big story for your paper because WARE is part of your coverage
WARE
area.
Is part of our coverage area. This is obviously something we're going to be looking at. These shootings are not common in New Hampshire. They are not exactly uncommon either. We had a, I think, rash of these shootings a couple of years back involving mentally ill folks who were there was a series of these incidents, including one in Concord, where folks who did suffer from mental illness were involved in situations where they were shot and in some cases killed by police officers. All of those situations were judged to be justified on the part of the police officers.
Yeah, interesting. Gary, your take on what this story represents. It's more than just, you know, an attempt to catch a suspect gone bad.
Well, from what we we don't know an awful lot because they haven't released an awful lot of information. But union leader reporter Mark Haywood went to the apartment building where the person who was shot lived and talked to people. And from what he could ascertain, it seemed as though he was basically a low-level drug dealer, probably unarmed. So there's a whole lot of questions that still are hanging out there that need answers before this is all done.
Yeah, Ben's paper editorialized, shooting a fleeing suspect who appears unarmed and isn't harming you, that's not the policy.
I don't think that's anybody's police policy, any town or city or state police. That's just not usually the way it's done.
Yet there's another piece to this story, gentlemen, and that's the alarming rise in heroin and other drug-related crime in northern New England, and not just in Manchester and Nashua. You know, small cities like Concord, little towns like Ware. We're seeing robberies. We're seeing other drug-related crimes. And Gary, police chiefs all over the state are saying, we are really alarmed about this. So there's a sort of a heightened level of fear and concern and feeling overwhelmed by this.
Oh, it is, and it's been going on for a while. I mean, the whole Connecticut Valley was really overwhelmed a couple of years ago by heroin literally coming up the river, if you will, from out of New York into Connecticut and up from Springfield, Mass, up to Keene, to Claremont, to Lebanon. And now we're seeing the same thing coming up out of Lowell and Lawrence. It's a very significant amount of hard drugs, hard narcotics coming into New Hampshire. And it's cheap now, which it didn't used to be, which is what's got everybody really concerned.
Yeah, we talked to the police chief of Manchester about this a couple weeks back. Ben, go ahead.
Well, and in addition to the police response to this alarming rise, there's also been a bill that's been retained at the State House, but that passed the House in a form this year. And that is something that would create a legal immunity for folks who call 911 for a medical emergency involving alcohol or drug overdoses. The idea being that if you are using drugs, there's someone with you who's also using drugs, this person has an overdose, you want them to get medical help. It's not, and you don't want to get arrested. So you create an immunity for that person so that they can call 911, they can get an ambulance to help their friend without fearing that they're going to be arrested. So you don't have a situation where someone's being dumped at an ER, dumped along the side of the road, and the police are being called.
Interesting.
That bill ran into some trouble in the House from folks who wanted to craft it very narrowly to make sure it did not protect, for example, drug dealers who provide, who sell this material. But I think that that's something that the Senate and the House are going to be looking at again in the coming months and certainly in January as this, I don't know if we can call it an epidemic yet, but this is an alarming situation.
All right. Well, I want to read a couple emails, both of you folks. They've come in on subjects that we've been talking about. And again, if you want to email us, exchange@nhpr.org is the address. The phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Here's one, Gary. I think I'll give it to you. This is from Diana, who says, what was Peter Bragdon's employment status immediately prior to accepting this LGC generous offer, and at what what salary. It seems he was able to accept this offer at the drop of a hat. Again, this gets back to Senate President Peter Bragdon, the story we reported on at the beginning of the show, saying that he will step down as Senate President to become Executive Director of the LGC. Do you know this level of detail, Gary?
Well, he had a slash real estate kind of development company that he ran himself. And as we all know, that's not exactly been a going industry in the state the last 5 or 6 years.
Although doing well now.
Doing well
now,
but it has not been really lucrative for a lot of people. So being Senate president is pretty much a full-time job. So there's a little time to really take care of your business when you have that position.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Diana, for the email. Did you want to jump in on that, Ben, as well? Or?
Well, I'm reminded again, some of the emails that were released this week, communications between Peter Bragdon and the LGC officials as he was talking to the job. One of the emails from him did say, you know, I find myself, while I love being in this volunteer legislature and leading it, that I actually do need to occasionally earn some money.
$125 a year is not a big salary.
Well, and he'll be going down to $100 once he's no longer Senate president, and he'll make $180,000. Dollars a year at the LGC. So that's quite a difference.
Here's another email that came in. This is Marty from Dalton. He says, it becomes more obvious at every attempt by Gary Long and Northern Pass that they know they are trying to do, what they know they are trying to do will be very detrimental to New Hampshire with no advantage to the state. Marty says the project should not be allowed unless the transmission lines are buried all the way. That's the only way this will be advantageous to New Hampshire, in that we would be receiving lease payments for the use of state rights of way. The reason it is not being considered is simply because PSNH wants the rental income. If burial would honestly make the project too expensive, Marty says, let them find another state. We don't want or need their power. Boy, there's a couple issues in this email, Marty, and thanks for it. What about this idea, Ben, bury it all the way?
Well, that's been, I think, a mantra for a lot of people who are opposed to this project, that it should be buried. And the latest version of the project, the latest route, includes about 8 miles of buried line. Now,
8 miles out of 140.
Out of 140, 187, I think, in all, including existing lines that would be hooked into. The problem that PSNH, that Northeast Utilities, that the Northern Pass folks say, is that it's very expensive to bury. That they said that I believe it went from $1.2 to $1.4 billion by burying those 8 lines and the route changes. So they say it would be prohibitively expensive to bury these lines all the way, but that in certain sensitive areas they're open to doing that. I think Marty's email indicates that he's one of these folks who isn't going to be convinced by a $7.5 million job fund that Northern Pass is a good thing if you're already convinced it's a bad thing in its current form.
Well, Marty, thanks for the email. And just to let you know, the Exchange will be following up on this story in a couple weeks. We're still working on putting that show together, but we do have an eye on it. I did want to ask both of you quickly about a story we covered a little last week. That's the national announcement that AOL was cutting way back on its patch project. This week, we learned a little bit more about the New Hampshire impact of this. Gary, super quick, just remind us again what patch is for those who don't know it.
Well, patch is a largely online news service that's very localized.
And hyper-local, we call it.
Hyper-localized. So it's just like you're having your weekly newspaper to yourself almost. We all know what happened to weekly newspapers. But the same thing sort of happened to patch here where they consolidated. And it wasn't so bad here as it was in some other places, but obviously we hit the two editors that were let go, and they consolidated some of the offices. But it is a online service that was started and taken over by AOL, who dumped about $70 million into it when they first took it over, and has been cutting back since on the expense.
Yeah, so according to some reporting by Bob Sanders in New Hampshire Business Review, as you said, Gary, two editors won't be with the organization, including Dan Tui, who's been a regular on our roundup. So I just want to publicly wish Dan very well. And
I think we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. What does this say to you, Ben? You work at a successful small paper, the Concord Monitor, about how papers deal with this hyper-local issue versus trying to serve a regional audience. It's very tough to figure out what people want and what they're going to read and what they're going to pay for.
Well, a big part of Patch's mission, its stated mission, has been that there are communities that don't get good coverage from newspapers as city newspapers have pulled back from regions, that there's been places, and this started, I think, in Connecticut, where you have a lot of towns frankly, wealthy towns that have a lot of advertising base that simply weren't being served by newspapers anymore. So you start up a local website. You have someone in the community who's very involved in covering it. And that's basically a good thing. We all want better news coverage of places. And I think a lot of the New Hampshire sites, when they opened up, were directed at larger towns, especially in the southern part of the state, that don't have daily newspapers in the community, that are covered by the Nashua Telegraph, that are covered by the Union Leader.
But not as extensively as people might want.
But not as extensively as folks in those towns might want. They also opened up in three cities that had daily newspapers, Concord, Portsmouth, and Nashua. I think what AOL has found, not just in New Hampshire but across the country, is that they have shareholder pressure. They were under a lot of pressure to make this stop losing money. Patch was losing a great deal of money every year as they very quickly expanded this national network. They were approaching, I think, 900 sites nationally, and now they're pulling back from that.
All right. Well, both of you, I always like to end these roundups by looking at what you'll be covering next week. Gary Reno, the week before the Labor Day weekend. What are you going to be keeping an eye on?
There's a big Medicaid expansion meeting this week where the stakeholders are going to come in. This is on Tuesday afternoon at Reps Hall. And they're going to come in and the hospitals, et cetera. The other thing that's really interesting that's going on is on Thursday, which is the electric deregulation oversight committee, where they're going to be deciding whether PSNH should be told that they have to sell off their fossil fuel generating facility.
Those are two huge stories, Medicaid expansion and electric deregulation. Wow, real interesting. And the week before Labor Day, I'm surprised. Ben, how about you?
Well, on Wednesday, we mentioned earlier the LGC study committee that the legislature has. They'll be meeting on Wednesday, and they'll be hearing from the three companies that really operate public risk pools in New Hampshire, the LGC, School Care, and Primex. So that'll give us a sense, I think, of whether the legislature is thinking about big changes to the public risk pool regulatory system.
All right. Both of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
This is NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we talk with New Hampshire Transportation Commissioner Christopher Clement about everything from red-listed bridges to a new study of rail. Then we sit down with NHPR President Betsy Gardella on the state of the station. And as always, we end the week with our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, reviewing the top stories in the Granite State. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR, where we get support from UR members and from Upton and Hatfield, providing legal services to individuals, businesses, and municipalities of the Granite State for over 100 years. Information at UptonHatfield.com. MPSU's Division of Online and Continuing Studies, helping you earn your degree evenings online and or days with a schedule that meets your needs. Plymouth.edu/DOCS.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm. A previously secret ruling from the surveillance court says the NSA violated U.S. law and the Constitution. The Obama administration declassified the opinion in an effort to gain control over the disclosure of government snooping. Those were leaks from Edward Snowden. In another high-profile leak case, Bradley